From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Russia investigation was on President Trump's mind this morning, as it has been since Friday, when court filings were released for the first time connecting Trump to a federal crime. According to the filings, Trump legal fixer Michael Cohen told prosecutors that Trump directed him to make those illegal payments right before the 2016 election to buy the silence of two women who allegedly had affairs with Trump. The president has been denying those transactions, but on Twitter this morning, he blasted away, writing, "So now the Dems go to a simple private transaction, wrongly calling it a campaign contribution." Trump is also unexpectedly scrambling to find his next chief of staff, and there's another government shutdown deadline. Let's set the table for the week with NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Hi, Mara.
Hi, Robin.
So the president has also been tweeting that he's totally cleared after these court filings, that those payments to Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal that he once denied even knowing about were private and not illegal. Additionally, those court filings showed that Russians reached out to Michael Cohen in 2015 offering political synergy. What do we have here?
Well, we have a legal cloud over the president that just isn't going away and actually is getting bigger. Now, it's hard to separate all this, but there really are two tracks. And the thing that the president usually talks about, which is the Russia part of the investigation, where he keeps on saying, "I've been exonerated, totally cleared, no collusion," that's one track. What he doesn't talk about as much until this morning on Twitter was the second part, where Michael Cohen told prosecutors that he was ordered by the president to make these illegal payments, in other words, to violate campaign finance laws. And in that tweet that you mentioned, when he says the Dems go to a simple private transaction, it's not the Dems. It's his own appointed New York attorney who has made these charges.
Yeah. Well,
it's not the special counsel.
Right. But it is.
It's the U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York.
Right. But it is some Democratic lawmakers who now say that those payments could be an impeachable offense. Here's New York Democrat and incoming chair of the House Judiciary Committee, Jerry Nadler, on CNN yesterday.
They would be impeachable offenses. Whether they are important enough to justify an impeachment is a different question, but certainly they'd be impeachable offenses because even though they were committed before the president became president, they were committed in the service of fraudulently obtaining the office.
And but other Democrats are voicing concern that impeachment or, you know, these trial proceedings could backfire. So what's your sense of this as we go in the next Congress?
I think that Jerry Nadler kind of summed up the internal debate inside the Democratic Party in Congress. Some Democrats want to impeach the president. Most Democrats do not, at least now. Impeachment is a political process, but it's also a political decision. And if the other thing to remember is impeachment is not removal. And even if the Democratic House could impeach the president, it's highly unlikely, actually impossible, that you'd find enough Republicans in the Senate who would convict and remove the president. So number one, it might not work. Number two, it could backfire. Remember when Bill Clinton was impeached in the House, he was not convicted in the Senate, and his popularity rose. It's possible that there could be a real backlash if this is done on just a partisan basis. And right now, it's hard to imagine that there could be a bipartisan call for impeachment based on what we know now.
Yeah. Well, of course, there is a chance that the president, who is president now, could be indicted after he leaves office. Right now, the Justice Department says a sitting president can't be indicted, so this could go on for years. But I want to ask more about the Michael Cohen Trump tower talks with Russia. He had lied about how long the Trump Organization was in touch with Russians. It went long into the campaign, those talks. But on NBC yesterday, the Kentucky Senator Rand Paul defended the president. Let's listen.
I see no problem with someone running for president trying to build a hotel somewhere. Now, if you were asking and saying, "I will give you something in exchange for letting us build a hotel," that would be wrong. But I haven't heard any evidence of that. Just trying to build a hotel somewhere, I can't imagine how that would be criminal.
Well, Mara, and he says no evidence, no direct proof of any quid pro quo, but people are drawing some, connecting some dots anyway about President Trump vilifying Obama in 2014 for not doing more about Russia seizing Crimea, and then softening that tone toward Russia in 2016 when we now know his company was in talks for a tower.
Right. And whether any of that is criminal or illegal is We're waiting for Bob Mueller to explain that to us. But the president went from denying categorically over and over again that he had no dealings in any way, shape, or form with Russia to saying, sure, during the campaign, I was negotiating to build a hotel in Moscow. I thought I wasn't going to win the White House. There's nothing wrong with that. So he has changed his story on that. And I think that this is something that's still unfolding. Whether the Russia part of the investigation will come up with a specific crime that the president committed, that remains to be seen.
Mara Liasson, NPR national political correspondent, thank you.
Thank you.
I can't breathe. Those were the last words of Jamal Khashoggi before the journalist was murdered inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. The new details come from a source who has read the transcript of an audio recording that describes the chilling moments before Khashoggi's death on October 2nd. U.S. and Turkish officials say their intelligence strongly suggests the Saudi crown prince ordered the murder. CNN's international diplomatic editor Nick Robertson broke the story, and he joins us now from London. Nick, it sounds like Khashoggi was attacked just minutes after he entered the consulate. What else have we learned from this transcript?
We've learned a lot. I think we can safely say that it was probably less than a minute after he walked into the consulate, because he immediately recognizes somebody there, Maher Abdulaziz Mutreb, who was a diplomat and intelligence officer at the Saudi embassy in London when Khashoggi worked there. So he knew him, and his immediate reaction was, what are you doing here? Mm. And to which Mutreb says, you're coming back. And he says, you can't do that. People are waiting for me outside. And then immediately after that very brief exchange, he is set upon by people in that room. And I think that's what tells us right there that the idea that this was never an operation to do anything less than kill him really begins to appear as a lie.
In other words, it was no rogue operation that went wrong.
It was not a rogue operation that went wrong. There's every indication that it was premeditated murder that was executed with ruthless efficiency. He was given no chance of any kind of conversation to say, no, I'm not going to go back to Saudi Arabia. I'm not going to do this. It was just immediately they were on him. And then very next thing that is heard is him saying, I can't breathe. I can't breathe, which again gives lie to what the Saudis said, that it was a tragic accident that he was killed. Well, the audio, the transcript of the audio recording makes it very clear he could be heard very clearly multiple times saying, I can't breathe.
Wow.
And clearly nothing was done to help that.
There's also this important question about several phone calls that were apparently made to Riyadh from the consulate. What do the transcripts tell us about that?
The transcripts tell us that there was disjointed conversations that Mutreb, who was the leader of the group, makes as the transcript indicates, a working hypothesis that Mutreb was making phone calls, because there are the conversations that he's having are one-sided, that only one side can be heard, his voice and nobody answering back in the conversation, and that it was discordant with the other conversations that were going on in the room. Therefore, the working hypothesis is that he was making calls. The Saudi officials we contacted for comment, didn't dispute any of the language that was used or any of the content of what was said in the room. They dispute that calls were made. They say that they've listened to the recording, that they've seen the transcript, and they don't see any evidence of phone calls. And the phone call is key to understanding, in part, that this operation, this killing operation, this murder, was reporting back, as Turkish sources have said, to somebody in the royal court of the crown prince in Saudi Arabia.
From what you can tell, is this the same information in this transcript that U.S. senators received last week when they had a private meeting with the CIA director?
That's our understanding, that conforms with what senators have heard. And as we've also heard over the weekend from Senator Lindsey Graham saying that there is a ton of intelligence linking that team to Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Senator Graham himself talked about there wasn't a smoking gun, and our source is very clear, there isn't a smoking gun in this. But the working hypothesis of several intelligence agencies that the source has talked to, the working hypothesis of those agencies is that this was a premeditated and planned murder, and that's the evidence that's presented there. And that's what Senator Lindsey Graham speaks about, no smoking gun, but a smoking sore.
Nick, can you shed any light on where these audio recordings came from. Who was taping this scene?
It's still not clear. Turkish authorities haven't put forward a logical explanation that stands the sniff test. The only conclusion that I think people are coming to at the moment is that the Turkish authorities were bugging the Saudi consulate, and that's where these recordings came from. What we do know is that as soon as the Turkish authorities that evening understood from Jamal Khashoggi's fiancée that something was wrong, they knew immediately what to do and listened to recordings and knew in a very short space of time that something untoward had happened, because they tried to search those Saudis who were going on those private jets at the end of the day back to Riyadh.
That's CNN International Diplomatic Editor Nick Robertson speaking to us from London. Nick, thanks very much for your reporting.
Thank you too.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo tweeted today, the UN's Human Rights Day, that Americans should remember the hostages held in Iran, including Bob Levinson. But Levinson's family feels Americans have forgotten him. So does Diane Foley, mother of journalist James Foley, who was kidnapped and brutally murdered by ISIS in Syria in 2014. We spoke recently. Her foundation tries to bring awareness about detainees, including the families of seven men held prisoner in Iran, who recently published an open letter to world leaders pleading for their help. There are more detainees in Iran, but their families worry speaking out may actually make them more valuable as hostages. Well, our next guests say they have to take that chance. Sarah Moriarty is the daughter of American Robert Levinson, who Pompeo tweeted about. He's been missing in Iran for more than 11 years. She was part of that recent letter and joins us from New York. Sarah, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
We're also joined by Nadim Zaka. His father is Nizar Zaka, a Lebanese national and U.S. legal permanent resident who was kidnapped in Iran in 2015. And Nadim joins us from KUHF in Houston. Nadim, welcome to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
Well, boy, what a tough thing. I mean, we're so sorry. Such a void. And we feel we don't hear enough about detainees anymore. Is that what brought you and other families together at this point? Sarah, you start.
Yes, we actually met on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly, and several families met together, and we realized that all of our stories were so similar, our frustrations with getting attention on our loved ones' cases, as well as our challenges in dealing with our own governments.
Well, Nadim, your father was a U.S. legal permanent resident, a world-renowned freedom of speech advocate, and the only detainee who was invited into Iran by the government there, only to then be snatched.
My father was invited by the vice president of Iran at the time to speak at one of her conferences on women's role in entrepreneurship. After attending her conference and even having dinner with her and her crew, my father got kidnapped on his way to the airport by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard.
And recently, as you write in this letter, President Rouhani's advisor admitted that this kidnapping was not approved by the government. Does that seem possible?
The same person that invited my father to attend the conference put out that interview through the Associated Press saying it was a mistake and it's in no way acceptable. Now, again, my father was kidnapped by the IRGC, whether they're having issues internally or whether they're just throwing the blame towards someone else, I really don't know.
Now, you have no way of knowing if this was a setup, if even the invitation was a setup.
It reached to a point where they're inviting known people, they're inviting people that they know that people are going to ask about just so they can use them as bargaining chips.
I would just add, they are being used as bargaining chips. There's been 20 individuals who have been taken by the Iranian government or Iranian authorities since my father was taken 11 and a half years ago. Our letter represents seven of them, but there are more. And this continues to happen and will continue to happen if the Iranians are not held accountable for it. That's what we're asking for in this letter, is for concrete steps.
Well, Sarah, let us talk about your father, Robert Levinson. You call him Bob. He had been a private investigator, a former FBI agent, reportedly was a part-time consultant for the CIA when this happened, reportedly trying to get an informant in Iran when he disappeared. Now, the U.S. claimed he was working on a cigarette smuggling case. They had to retract that. It became a huge scandal at the CIA. People lost their jobs for what the New York Times calls an unauthorized spying operation. In fact, your father sent out an email to a friend before he did this, saying, I'm questioning why at this point, with seven kids and a great wife, why I'd put myself in this jeopardy. You know, people might say to you, and I'm sure they have, well, this is different. That's a risk he took, you know, working for the CIA, maybe even a rogue operation. And I'm thinking your response might be, actually, you know, since he was in service to the U.S., there's more reason for the country to take care of him.
Well, first of all, my father was not hiding anything. When he went over there, he went under his own name and his own passport. He was there for both private business and as a contractor for our government. He has been kept without his most basic human rights for 11 and a half years. We don't understand why there is not more of an outrage. This man, my father, is 70 years old. He's not in good health from all reports that we've received. And he was there on behalf of the U.S. government. His two passions were his family and the U.S. government. He was one of the first to be held, and he's always been left behind by our government, and he shouldn't be any longer. He needs to be first to come home.
In March, on the 11th anniversary of your father's disappearance, you had an event with his FBI colleagues to try to draw attention to his detention. You know, we're seeing the American ambassador in Berlin sending out your letter, agreeing with you. We hear that the Trump administration has been vocal about trying to bring your father home. What's your sense of what the U.S. government is doing?
I think they're trying hard. I think it will never be enough until my father is brought home. I am so appreciative for Ambassador Grinnell's efforts. He has been one of our biggest proponents since my mother and I met with him in September. Ambassador Haley has also started to take up the cause. But we need more from administration officials. We need them to put this at the forefront of every single conversation they have.
Nadim, you have been in contact with your dad. What's his life like?
Well, my dad right now lives underground with about 20 to 30 other people in a rat-infested cell with cockroaches and bedbugs all over the ground. He's currently with another U.S. citizen, namely Zhuang, who was a Princeton student that was doing his doctorate and got kidnapped as well. The worst part about being able to speak to my dad, I would say, is that when they're in Iran, when they're held, they're getting tortured mentally and physically. So, and when they're getting tortured mentally, they use family members, they use phone calls to play mind games with their detainees. I've had to argue with my father all the way across the world. They would basically try to convince their detainees, for example, with their kids, like, your kids are living their own lives, they don't care about you, they're not asking about you, that their spouses left them behind and found someone else. So when I'm trying to help my dad, all I'm getting is feedback from him saying, you did this, you did that. And it's all paranoia that's instilled by his captives.
What a nightmare. I understand, though, that there are also times when you're trying to cheer him up, but he's more concerned with cheering you up.
At the end of the day, he is my father, and he's, in my opinion, he is one of the greatest men that ever came. He devoted his life for advocating freedom of speech and freedom of the internet. He feels sometimes that he needs to watch out for us. He's always hopeful that he'll leave. Some days I just hear him talking and I think to myself, how can he be so strong being held in Iran? How can he have no fear from the authorities, and his life is at stake every day? No one can really do anything to get him out, and at the same time, no one can stop them from doing anything to him. No one can stop them from torturing my father.
We are seeing what's happening, the rage at what happened to an American journalist that the CIA believes was killed by a hit squad from Saudi Arabia. Sarah, I'll ask you, I can see you saying, we want to have justice for Jamal Khashoggi, but what about my dad?
We've seen international outcry in that case, and we're looking for that as well. We want every citizen to call up their government. These individuals have been tortured. They've been in solitary confinement. They've been denied medical care. Several have never received a fair trial. My dad has had no trial, and action needs to be taken, and each individual person can ask their governments to take further action and concrete steps.
Sarah, would you tick off the other names? I'm seeing Saeed Malakpour, 10 years held captive in Iran, Cameron Gaderi, an Austrian-Iranian citizen IT consultant. He was on a regular business trip, held in solitary confinement, forced to write a confession. He's had operations. Tell us some of the names.
Ahmadreza Dajali and Bakr and Saeed Meknamazi. Saeed had a heart attack recently. Ahmadreza had to have emergency surgery. Everyone's stories are so deeply upsetting, and there should be international outcry. And the hardest part is that my family has not had any contact with my father for the 11 and a half years. And to hear these families suffering as well, it's very hard.
You take on their pain, too. Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Ahmadreza Dajali, the Swedish-Iranian scientist, was invited by Iranian universities to develop training. He was arrested by the government in 2016. And you mentioned Bakr and Siamak Namazi, a father and son, watching each other waste away. Just terrible.
Having built this friendship with these other families is so important now that all of them come home.
Yeah, because you'd probably feel guilt if one did and the rest didn't. Hey, by the way, how's your mother?
She's okay. It's very hard.
Oh,
it gets harder every day, I think, especially around the holidays.
Yeah. Nadim, is it hard to, like, get up every day and go about your life? I mean, how often is this on your mind?
When my dad first got kidnapped, my whole life turned around. I was in college. I was trying to finish up my bachelor's. You know, after that happened to my dad, I had to go ahead and, you know, be with my family and work with my family to get through this. And it's really taken a toll on my life personally. Mm. But no one's gonna ask for my father's release more than I am. No one's gonna want his release more than I do. So that's why I do it, because I know no one's gonna work as hard.
We've been speaking with Sarah Moriarty and Nadim Zaka, both of their fathers being detained in Iran. We'll post their letter to the international community at hearnow.org. Nadim, thank you, and best to you.
Thank you again for having me, Ron.
Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
That powerful winter storm that struck the southeastern U.S. over the weekend killed at least one motorist, left more than 300,000 customers without power across the Carolinas. Here's North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper urging residents to stay home and off the roads.
Don't put your life and the lives of first responders at risk by getting out on roads covered with snow and ice. Instead, stay put if you can. Wrap a few presents, decorate the tree, and watch some football.
Well, Rebecca Martinez joins us now from WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Rebecca, when we hear, as we do, there's been record snowfall in parts of North Carolina, what are we talking about?
Well, I know that the Triad out in the western part of the Piedmont of the state got up to 15 inches, and it didn't rain much overnight. In the Triangle, there was about 12 inches in some places, but it did rain overnight and washed a lot of the snow off the roads, which was nice for my early morning commute, but it also washed the brine off with it. So now that it's snowing here again, I've got a slippery commute home ahead of me later today.
Right. And when you say the Triangle, Raleigh?
Yes, the Raleigh-Durham Chapel Hill area.
Right, right. And it's an area that does get some snow, but that's a lot of snow and also now potentially, well, slick roads and ice.
Yes, absolutely. And I would say that our State Department of Transportation has tried to let people know that they would be out in force However, we don't necessarily have the snowplow infrastructure that other states might. And so I think they're working as hard as they can to keep up with the need. Yet there is still a lot of snowfall covering the roads. I-40, which is a main thoroughfare down here, is completely covered.
Well, as we said, North Carolina does get snow, but 15 inches, that's a lot. And this is a state that a lot of snowbirds are making their new snowbird state. Instead of going all the way down to Florida, they're coming down from the colder states to North Carolina. So this has got to be, you know, kind of shocking to them. But what about efforts to get the power back on? And we mentioned one motorist. People might have read about the poor motorist who, you know, a tree fell on the car. What about other people possibly missing?
So, yes, a driver was killed after a tree branch fell on their car. That was in the Charlotte area. And in eastern North Carolina, we know that a tractor trailer skidded off the road. And dive crews have gone into the Neuse River looking for the driver, but still have not located anyone. So we're not sure yet what has happened there. So far, the Department of Transportation has reported 600 collisions since the start of the storm, and 1,000 people have called for help. And we understand that black ice is likely to be a problem until tomorrow.
Yeah. And some parts of the state were hard hit by hurricanes in the fall. So are they also being hit by the storm, or were they spared?
Well, sure. Hurricane Florence hit many of the same areas that Hurricane Matthew did in 2016. And the hurricane meant that many school districts lost many days of school. Some schools closed for 21 days. And a special law was written to waive some of their class requirement. Luckily, it appears that this snowstorm has spared many of the towns in that region. And the storm really seems to be bearing down on the areas west of there. However, along the coast, on the Outer Banks, there is a highway that's seeing a lot of ocean overwash and really heavy winds as well.
So power lines down, airports, you know, check your flights because a lot have been canceled. Rough going there in North Carolina. Rebecca Martinez from WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Rebecca, thank you.
You're welcome.
Tomorrow, officials in Minneapolis will begin relocating people from a large outdoor homeless encampment into a new shelter. It's a controversial decision. Many of the people living there are Native Americans, and there are questions about whether they should get priority at the new shelter. At a meeting yesterday, tensions flared. Joining us now is Minnesota Public Radio's Max Nesterak. And Max, you've been out to this camp. What's it like?
Well, the conditions right now are really cold, as you would expect in Minnesota in December. It's about 20 degrees. I think it's been freezing for the past few weeks now. And so, you know, people are just trying to stay warm.
So at one point, it looks like there were about 200 tents in this camp. It's estimated that 80% of the people who were living there are Native Americans, which is an interesting twist to this story. How did it come to be that so many people living there were Native Americans?
I don't know how to answer the question about why is it so largely Native American, except that Native Americans experience homelessness at one of the highest rates out of any other group. And the location of the encampment is in an area, the Phillips neighborhood of Minneapolis, which is has a high population of Native American people. It's by this stretch of Franklin Avenue, which is called the American Indian Corridor, which has a lot of Native American-owned businesses, nonprofits, clinics, a coffee shop called Powwow Grounds. And so this has always been a cultural center for Native American people living in Minneapolis. And this encampment has just become a touchstone for that community.
Sure. And there's this plan now to move those people into a safer place for the winter. But as we've heard at the top there, it's a pretty controversial idea. How did this become such a challenge for the city?
So just across the street, 8 lanes across this highway called Hiawatha Avenue, they're setting up 3 temporary shelters called a navigation center. And this was supposed to be Minneapolis's new approach to dealing with homelessness, which means it's going to be low barrier. You're not going to be turned away if you're high or drunk. You can come with extended relatives. You know, you don't have to pay to get in as you do in some shelters. And the challenge, I think, here is that people feel like they're just being relocated to another place. And that's obviously been something that's come up through Native American history over time, is having to move from one place to another. And so the irony that Native American leaders would have to relocate their own people to another temporary space is not lost on them. However, this land by the side of a highway is not a safe place for people to live. And so that's why there's really this push to get people into something safer, at least for the short term.
So they're moving people without really addressing the root cause of why they're homeless in the first place. Is that right?
I wouldn't say that. I think what's interesting that's come out of this is the Red Lake Nation has really been a leader in trying to find people housing. And so they contracted with this nonprofit called Avivo, and they've pledged to try and find 100 people from the encampment housing over the next 6 months. And so far, they've been able to find about 50 people housing through accessing a state fund, a state pool of resources called housing support. And so people are focused on long-term housing. And actually on the site where this navigation center is, they're going to break ground in June on a 109-unit apartment building called Mino Bima Dijuin, which means a good life in Ojibwe. And this is supposed to be affordable housing for Native American people. So people are trying to keep the long-term solutions in mind.
Homeless camps are not something new in this country. Cities around the U.S. have taken different approaches to dealing with them. We're seeing how Minneapolis is dealing with this problem. But what strikes me is that Minneapolis is one of the coldest cities in the country. I'm surprised that the problem of people living on the streets has even gotten that big.
Right. And, you know, Hennepin County, where Minneapolis is, has a guarantee that any family can stay somewhere warm at night. They, even if they have to pay for a hotel, they will guarantee shelter for families. But there's a lot of reasons why people don't want to go to shelter. It doesn't feel safe. There are barriers. You have to split up from your extended families. You have to be sober. And so what people are saying is it's a better choice for them to live in a tent by the side of the highway than go into shelter. And so that may tell you something about the shelter system in Minneapolis, and which is probably similar to how it is across the country.
Yeah. Max Nesterak, producer and reporter at Minnesota Public Radio. Max, thank you.
You're welcome.
And many people in that camp are addicted to opioids. There are daily reports of overdoses, another sign of the opioid crisis in this country. Last year, there were more than 70,000 drug overdose deaths. It's the highest in a single year in the U.S. The crisis has caused many doctors and patients to rethink how pain is treated, including reducing how many painkillers are prescribed. And that's a scary prospect for people who suffer from regular pain. For member station KCUR, Alex Smith says people with sickle cell disease are trying to manage their pain without becoming addicted to opioids.
Long before Eric Kirkwood of Kansas City, Kansas, had his first sickle cell crisis at age 17, he knew about the pain caused by the disease. His uncle and sister had the genetic disorder, which causes blood cells to clump together and cut off circulation.
It's like being in a vise or something, like needles coming from inside out. It's like the air being sucked out of your body.
About 100,000 people in the United States have sickle cell disease, and the overwhelming majority of them are black. The disease can cut life expectancy by decades, and until recently, sickle cell treatment was almost palliative care, treating the pain without much thought about the consequences. Patients like Kirkwood found relief in opioids that were as dangerous as they were potent.
Demerol was the bomb. So, you know, something like that, it's easy to get addicted to.
Today, 40 years later, newer drugs that improve blood function have improved the quality of life for many patients. And concerns about the harms of opioids have led sickle cell specialists to take different approaches to treating pain.
Yeah. Hey, buddy.
He says, I'm 4 years old, 85 pounds, and I love everybody.
A therapy dog visits Kenneth James, a jazz pianist recovering from a crisis at the Sickle Cell Center at Truman Medical Center in Kansas City. Nurse practitioner Donna McCurry, who regularly treats about 100 patients here, encourages alternative treatments like meditation, music, and exercise, which have been found to reduce the need for opioid treatment.
I've had a couple of people get off of it altogether after being on it for years, and their pain is better.
But getting people in pain to give up pills in favor of dogs or mantras isn't easy, and it's an especially thorny issue for sickle cell patients. Because the disease can cause both acute and chronic pain, patients often have to take so many opioids that they develop high tolerances for them. As a result, they may need opioids at doses that would be dangerous for other people. Dr. Bree Andamarian is the chief medical officer for the Sickle Cell Disease Association of America. She says many doctors who don't understand the disease treat these patients with suspicion.
This is also
of major concern to providers and emergency departments and hospitals who are not particularly familiar with that patient and may wonder why the patient is asking for such high doses.
Along with a lack of knowledge about sickle cell disease, researchers have found that, in general, doctors in the U.S. underestimate Black people's pain and the amount of pain medication they need. Sickle cell patients are no more likely to abuse opioids than many other chronic pain patients, according to researchers, but lots of them, like Kenneth James, have horror stories about trying to get treatment.
I've had one doctor in the ER tell me that at least 30 to 40% of the patients with sickle cell were drug addicts, and that's not true.
Now that some states are limiting opioid prescriptions, government agencies are rewriting opioid guidelines, and some insurance companies have even stopped covering them, many sickle cell patients worry they could lose access to opioids. For James, the possibility of lawmakers or insurers taking pain medications away brings back bitter memories of being denied care.
And they're making all these laws and saying, well, you know, we don't want you to have that no more. What do you mean you don't want me to have that more? I need that to at least survive. You don't have it. You can't relate, but you're going to make the rules and laws. I just don't think it's fair.
Or related to your sickle cell.
It hurts like sickle cell pain, and other times it just aches.
Eric Kirkwood pays a visit to Donna McCurry and tells her that his pain has been pretty manageable lately. He credits a new drug, herbal medicine, and transcendental meditation. Curry acknowledges that many of her patients couldn't get by without opioids, but she wants them on the lowest doses possible. But instead of simply taking away their pills, she tries to coach them on improving their lives.
I know I can help you change this because I've seen it. I know you don't have to struggle with this the way you are. If we can just get past this script thing.
And by understanding what sickle cell patients go through, she hopes to ease them away from the double grip of pain and painkillers. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Smith.
And is it finally time to exonerate millennials? The generation born between the early 80s and late 90s has been blamed for decreased population. They have fewer children. They're accused of killing off golf, department stores, napkins, canned tuna, housing sales, and cars. But a new report from the Federal Reserve says they're not killing these things. The cost of these things is killing them. That millennials are less well off than members of earlier generations when they were young, with lower earnings, fewer assets, and less wealth. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. You may have seen his piece, Millennials Didn't Kill the Economy, the Economy Killed Millennials. He joins us as he does every Monday from New York. Hi, Derek.
Hello.
So a lot of millennials are probably saying, see, it's true. But talk about, for instance, home ownership and compare millennials to previous generations. I'm surprised by this.
Yeah, there's a lot of surprising statistics in this study. And I should probably begin by saying that, full disclosure, I was born in 1986, which means that I am a millennial. So some people might say, oh, he's just trying to exonerate his own generation. Well, indeed, I am trying to exonerate my own generation. But yeah, let's take a look at houses. So for a long time, there's been this sense that young people were buying fewer houses than previous generations. This bears out in the data. The home ownership rate among young people today is significantly lower than the home ownership rate among similarly young people in previous decades.
Like
okay,
boomers.
So why is that?
Yeah,
right, like baby boomers,
yeah.
Generation X. So why is that? Maybe it's because young people today don't want houses, possible, or it's because they do want houses, but houses are too expensive for them.
I could have told you that.
Yes. It's amazing how much just a little bit of thinking can puncture this myth that, in fact, millennials want to destroy every feature of the consumer economy. So, you know, if you look at, for example, the Joint Center for Housing Studies of Harvard University, the price-to-earnings ratio has gone up across the country since the 1980s. It's doubled in metros such as Miami, Denver, Seattle. That means it is twice as difficult to buy a house with a median income in that area. So It's not just the case that young people say don't want houses, don't want cars. I think they do want these things. But as the Federal Reserve said, millennials are much poorer than previous generations because they've come of age after this great recession. That is the key here.
Well, and also they've come of age at a time when they were told you have to go to college. So they did. And they have huge debt.
Yeah, this is an inescapable part of the story. You now have over $1 trillion in outstanding student loan debt. And for many people, student loan debt is a burden that can be bared somewhat. If they have, you know, $3,000, $4,000 of student debt, but maybe they're making, you know, above the median income in the U.S., above maybe $60,000 in the U.S., they can pay off their student loans. But what seems to happen is that as they have this overhang of debt from their past, it makes it more difficult to get new loans, say a car loan to get a new car, or a housing loan, a mortgage to buy a house. And as a result, going to college has essentially pushed into the future a lot of these trappings of adulthood. It has delayed marriage, delayed childbirth, delayed that first car purchase, and delayed that housing purchase. So it's not the case that 25-year-olds, I think, are so different, you know, genetically and in terms of their preferences as previous generations, but rather that it's just going to take them a little bit longer to get to the point that we're used to 25-year-olds being yet in terms of participating in the consumer economy.
Could you explain to me one aspect of this? It's said that you know, these young consumers, 25 to 34, are spending less at traditional grocers, and people are citing things like canned tuna and napkins. And I found myself saying, who buys napkins when you're 25 anyway? I mean, that just doesn't follow.
This is a really, really important point. I think it's very typical for millennials to be blamed for cultural or economic changes when their only crime is behaving like everybody else. So, for example, the Wall Street Journal had a piece last year where they blamed young people for killing grocery stores. The proof was that people between 25 and 34 are less likely to spend as much money at grocery stores as they were in previous generations. Okay, that seems somewhat damning. But when you look a little bit closer at the evidence, everybody is spending less at grocery stores. They're shopping more at convenience stores like CVS. They're buying food at dollar stores. They're going to superstores like Walmart that aren't considered grocery stores in the government data. And then also Americans of all ages are eating out at restaurants more. So you put it all together and it actually turns out that the group that is moving quickest away from grocery stores toward restaurants isn't 20-somethings. It's senior citizens. It's people over the age of 65. But because when we see a novel trend, we tend to associate it with the most novel entrance into the consumer economy, millennials. Millennials bear blame for that which everybody is doing. Well, grocery store sales are down. Everything else is
Well, aren't they just taking the place of baby boomers who were also blamed for everything? You know, they were said to ignore climate change, but it was baby boomers who were actually fighting for the environment as well. You know, it's just that we tend to blame these young generations.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think that culture in general has an anti-young bias. And I think we have an anti-young bias because we want to – I think part of it, frankly, is people feeling a kind of hometown pride about their own generation, that they want to think that Gen X either had it worst or, you know, is overcoming the most, or that the baby boomers are the most important generation. As a result, we stigmatize and otherize.
We're always
– let's all agree that grocery stores are fine and we can eat out at restaurants together.
It's high school all over again. Derek Thompson of The Atlantic. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.